This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, Dr. Lyle. How are you doing today?
Good, good to hear your voice again.
Likewise. I guess you're the only one. So.
Yeah. That's all right.
Thank you very much for...
Go ahead.
All right, so thanks very much last week for taking care of the technical difficulties. I'm sure listeners had a much funner time listening to your introduction than my voice.
Ah, sure. That's what I think. No, just kidding. Let's roll. What do we got on deck?
All right. So this week, and actually last week, we had an episode about the psychology of the elections and politics, and a little bit about Trump and Clinton. And I got a number of emails from a lot of different listeners from a lot of different subjects. Mm-hmm. What we did for this show today is to go over some of the listener questions and comments. Now, we're a live show, so you can call in and callers will take priority. But in the meantime, what we're going to do is ask you some questions that people emailed me, and we're going to get to as many as we possibly can. Granted, there's a lot of you that emailed me, and so I really want to thank you guys. And so whatever questions that I don't get to this time, we're going to save for another show that's dedicated to more listener questions and comments. So let's get started.
All right.
All right, Dr. Lyle. So this listener wants to understand, what is Dr. Lyle's take on both of the candidates, Trump and Clinton, and why they appeal or repulse certain segments? I'd also like him to speak on how political correctness can be so diametrically opposed to our genes and what the impact of political correctness is upon our instincts.
Well, you know, these are interesting questions. That's a very interesting bunch of speculation whirling around in that listener's head. Politics is going to be a person's political preferences individually. We talked about last week. Let me sort of separate out psychology into two very different segments. The first segment is going to be what we're going to call general psychology. So these are going to be the general principles of how psychology works in all humans. This would be the equivalent of Gray's Anatomy. So the Gray's Anatomy is going to work everywhere in the world. Everywhere in the world, the kidney and the liver and everything is going to be in the same place. Then there's going to be the second half of psychology is going to be what we're going to call personality. And personality is going to be the study of individual differences between people, so how everybody's kidney is different. So under general psychology, we would probably reasonably study sex differences. In other words, in some ways all females are the same, and in some ways all males are the same, and in some ways males and females are reliably different. That would go under general psychology, although it starts to essentially leak its way into the concept of personality in the sense that a person is not a person as a person. A person is either a man or a woman, and that has profound consequences for a lot of their characteristics. Now, so last week we talked about politics, and we talked about how essentially politics derives from the Stone Age village problem of share, not share. And so we talked about that essentially the political two poles that you see that emerge in human nature, in human politics, are going to be sharing and not sharing, which is the equivalent of the left and right wing or liberal and conservative is what we call them in the United States, with liberal being the share dimension and conservative being the not share dimension. And we talked about where an individual is on the dimension of how they perceive the resource stability of the adaptive landscape. And so, therefore, those who see the adaptive landscape as more variable and capricious and therefore more essentially intimidating are going to tend to be liberal, all things being equal. And people that tend to see the adaptive landscape as more stable, et cetera, are going to be more conservative. So these are reasonable inferences and decisions that all human brains would make given the given set of circumstances. Now, now what we're going to do is we're going to move inside the problem as to the question that the listener asks is why, I guess, some candidates are, you know, repulsive or attractive to different people. And so some of that is going to come because if you happen to be, for example, a person who is in circumstances or you've made the inferences that the world is economically capricious, then you are more likely to be thinking that we should be sharing more, and therefore you're likely to be liberal. So that's going to be one reason why certain candidates are going to appeal or repulse certain segments. But it goes beyond this. So even once we take this out of it, like where you happen to be on that dimension, there's other aspects to whether or not someone is more conservative or liberal that have to do with the individual differences in the person's genes. So if we start to think through a template of what liberal or conservative would look like, we would go through what we're going to call the Big Five, and we could also actually also look at IQ, and we would find in really IQ is not particularly related to liberal or conservative, which of course everybody on either side is going to be upset and say that it is, but it isn't. So what we're really going to look at is we're going to look at the Big Five, and we're not going to add IQ to this. So once we pull IQ out of personality, we're going to now look at openness to experience, conscientiousness, introversion, extroversion, agreeableness, disagreeableness, and emotional stability. And what we're going to find is that we're going to find that liberals are more open to experience and conservatives are less open to experience. So this is going to be like an easily demonstrable phenomenon of individual differences in political preference. So what we're now going to see is something useful maybe for our listeners to understand, and that is that your political preferences are not inferences based on superior logic to the other guy. They have to do with, number one, your circumstances with respect to share or not share in terms of what seems to be your interests or the group's best interest on that dimension, and all alternatively and additionally, your personal individual personality genetics. So if you are more open to experience, it is very likely that you are liberal, and if you are very conventional and not so wild, you are much more likely to be inherently conservative. And of course, as we see, that the genes have built this thing in a bell curve, so nobody is right, and we're going to see that the optimal personality for the average member of the species under average circumstances is going to be right down the middle. And so there you go on that dimension. Now, the next one would be conscientiousness. And now everybody would want to say that they are more conscientious, but as we measure conscientiousness, interestingly enough, we're going to find that conservatives are more conscientious than liberals. And this means they've got more anxiety about getting things done properly and right and so on and so forth. And now for on a sort of moral dimension, the liberals would be upset at this sort of inference because they're, of course, much more concerned about the environment and the fish and this and that. So isn't that conscientiousness? No, that's just one component of conscientiousness. And the fact that liberals would be much more conscientious on those dimensions is not, in fact, going to change the scorekeeping. So the liberals are going to be more open to experience, and they're going to be less conscientious. If anybody wants to test this, they can just look at credit scores, for example, and we're going to find that this is going to come out of the data. Now, the next thing that we would look for is introversion, extroversion. And I don't know that there's a strong difference here. So I have a feeling that that this individual difference variable may be unrelated to politics. I have a feeling that it is. The next dimension, agreeable disagreeable, is related to politics, and I believe that conservatives are more disagreeable, and so this is I think this is these things are probably. They're probably relatively small effect sizes. So on each of these things, we might find that, for example, on openness to experience, we might find the average Democrat to be at the 57th percentile of that dimension and the average conservative to be at the 43rd percentile. In other words, I'm not sure how big those effect sizes are. They're not likely to be huge, but they're likely to be measurable. The same with the conscientiousness and the same with the agreeable disagreeable dimension. Emotionally stable, I'm not sure, and I couldn't tell you. But the three that I believe that there are correlation coefficients established for are openness, conscientiousness, and agreeable disagreeable. And so we are going to see that the big five are going to be pulling correlations, which essentially are going to tell us something that first was indicated in the monozygotic twin studies out of Minnesota, which is that your political beliefs are amazingly genetic. And so there's no way that you could get correlations out of two people that grew up in entirely different households, a whole set of them, that were separated at birth and raised by different people under entirely different circumstances, and that they wind up being remarkably concordant with their politics. That could have only happened if politics was associated with the genetic variation in personality characteristics, and it turns out that it is. So that's that will tell you why some candidates appeal to you and some candidates repulse you, because if you are a conservative, then typically candidates who have a more liberal bent will be signaling their affinity for openness to experience, agreeableness, and less conscientiousness. And the opposite will be on the mirror image will be on the other side, and so you're going to be typically uncomfortable with people that are on the other side of the fence.
You know, I remember you explaining this one time in a live lecture, and you explained it so well that I had been very involved, just interested in politics, for the reason of trying to convince other people to my position. And an hour after you explained it, I realized I was suddenly completely uninterested in politics after that.
Yeah, you start to realize this is a total waste of time. Yeah. And that you're not going to be convincing anybody on the other side that they lack clarity or intelligence, and that's why they've arrived at the positions they've arrived at. You're no more going to do that than change their eye color. And
right.
So this is people will say, oh, well, that's not true. When I was 16, I was a conservative, and then by 19, I was a liberal. Yeah, well, that's because you were under your parents' thumb and didn't know anything for a while. But as soon as you happen to, your little genes found their way to their right place in the world, there you are and there you stay. So it isn't to say that people cannot be, sometimes have their mind changed by rational argument on some things. That is possible. It's just not very likely. And so, yes, I agree. I mean, politics is inherently intriguing because we feel – like this is important. Now, the truth of the matter is, this is an illusion that politics used to be important. It was important 15,000 years ago. It was important that the leadership of the village, that you participated in the process of trying to make sure leadership was assigned to the right person, because the wrong person could mess up negotiations with the people on the other side of the river. They could take us into a bad direction or dangerous direction just because they had too big of an ego. In other words, there was actually some pretty serious consequences, and therefore constant vetting of the sort of political power structure and whether it was serving the interests of the village. Today, essentially your life and what's going to happen with your life and your family's life has essentially nothing to do with Washington. And so, therefore, all that's happening is this is tickling an ancient instinct as if it's important, and yet, in the final analysis, it's utterly unimportant. That's my view, and actually, all the scientific evidence would support this.
I've often wondered if we could sit down some of these big name politicians, like some guys on the left and some guys on the right, and kind of explain this to them. Would they just suddenly become uninterested and quit their jobs? So, like, the guys who are honestly arguing, hoping to change people's minds, like they strongly believe that they're changing minds, not the liars who are just doing it for fun.
Sure.
But, yeah.
Yeah, there's people that actually believe in their position and they believe in the rightness of it, and it's extraordinary. And it is what it is, and so we're not going to worry about it. All right, so let's go
on to the next part. Okay, so next question. On a previous show, Dr. Lyle made a brief comment in the early days of the show. He alluded to the fact that meat can definitely be included in a very healthy diet, and how it would not be that detrimental. What's your take, Dr. Lyle? Please explain.
Oh, yes. Those in the vegan world, which some of the listeners will know me from that world, the vegan world and the scientists involved have been able to show some really remarkable health improvements from people going from a conventional diet to a whole natural foods diet. Nobody else has been able to demonstrate some of the things that we've been able to demonstrate, like Caldwell Esselstyn at the Cleveland Clinic, Dean Ornish at University of California, the reversal of atherogenesis, and so on and so forth. So that isn't in dispute. But what cannot logically be derived from that is the notion that a vegan diet is necessarily the healthiest diet. And it certainly cannot be derived from that including animal food in the diet is detrimental in any significant way. So I actually believe that, first of all, there's all kinds of interesting reasons and arguable reasons for excluding animal food from the human diet. And it is certainly not necessary, and anybody that thinks it's necessary in any way just doesn't have any clue of the facts. So there's no question that a vegan diet can achieve optimum health for people. That's not in any kind of scientific dispute. The issue is whether or not, if we include animal food in the diet, whether or not it is necessarily detrimental. I do not think so, and I certainly don't think that it was true in our natural history. Now, the animal food that anybody would eat today is not the same as the animal food that we ate in our natural history. The animal food in your natural history would have been healthier considerably. So if people today actually saw the health of the animals and how they were treated, of the animals that they were eating, they would be pretty freaked out, actually, over that. It's sort of remarkable that we're not worse off for eating animal food than we are, given the health of the animals that people are eating. However, the reason why I'm confident about this is that, first of all, it's clear that this creature is an omnivore. And it's also clear that in biology, there's a concept that we're going to call thresholds. So there are thresholds at which the differences from within the thresholds doesn't mean anything. So, for example, you might say, well, it'd be good to get sunlight every day. Well, really, how much? Okay, well, how about, 20 minutes gives me my vitamin D? Okay, well, would it do us any good to get 26 minutes? Is there any difference between 26 minutes and 26 minutes and 2 seconds? Does it change what about the arc relative to, where we are relative to the equator? What time of day is that 26 minutes? I.e., how many watts of sunlight should I be getting if I were to count them? What would be optimal? And the answer is don't be absurd. There's going to be a range that if you don't get enough, you're going to wind up with a vitamin D deficiency that you're going to have to correct somehow, or you're going to have health consequences. And if you get too much, you're going to get sunburn, and you're going to increase your likelihood of skin cancer and all kinds of other things. So the bottom line is of course, there's a range of which the system is well able to tolerate that. And nobody would actually know, even within that range, exactly what amount would be the least stress on the organism. So there's going to be essentially functionally equivalent amounts of sunshine that are going to do the job that people need to have it done, and essentially there's no possible way for us to figure out whether a little more or a little less is better. And the same thing is going to be true with animal food. At this point, there is no compelling evidence to suggest that if you were to include, let's suppose that we talked about 10% of your calories or even 20% of your calories from animal food, there's no compelling evidence to suggest that that would inherently be negative for humans. Now, however, it is interesting, that if you have a person that already has very serious coronary artery disease as a result of far too much rich food, including animal food, oil, et cetera, in the diet, too much unnatural food and too much animal food, if you already have coronary artery disease, it is truth that you are not going to reverse that coronary artery disease probably with a diet with 20% animal food in it, but you will reverse it if we have a non-oil diet with 0% animal food in it. So it is interesting that we can demonstrate superiority in curing a pathology, but that's not the same question as whether or not this is actually costly to the organism as long as we are below the critical thresholds for generating the pathology. So this is why it is that I will say that I'm of course certain that let's take this to the extreme just for the principle to be demonstrated one more time. Let's suppose, for example, we say, well, how about if I have one bite of tuna fish a year? Is that going to make any difference? Well, any reasonable person would say, well, of course not. It's inconceivable that could make a difference. Well, how about one bite a week? Well, you know, I can't possibly see any evidence that would suggest that. Well, then how about one a day? So where do we draw the line? And when we look at the correlation coefficients worldwide and we look at epidemiological evidence as you include more animal food in the diet and what happens pathologically, what I see is that when people start eating large amounts of animal food and other food that is processed, particularly oils, refined carbohydrates, et cetera, when you start having a diet that is full of those foods, we start to see very significant rises in pathology. But we do not have evidence that it's taking place at small percentages. So I believe that the human organism was certainly robust to a diet of whole natural foods in its natural history that included animal food in the diet, and I don't think that I would expect any pathology to have resulted from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in my practice, I tell my patients that there's a big difference between maintaining health and then reversing disease. And if they're at the stage where they have to reverse disease, they're going to have to behave a lot more than if they're just kind of maintaining what they're currently at.
Absolutely. You know, it's a good example would be if you have a sunburn, when you go out in the sun, it hurts. It's like that's trouble. You're in trouble. But that same amount of sun is fine when you don't have a sunburn. And so that's how I would look at the
inclusion of animal
food in the diet.
That's a really great example. Yeah, that's a great example because I got a sunburn, you know, a couple months ago, and I remember exactly what that felt like after going into the sun.
Right. You got it. All right, let's go on.
Okay, so this next listener sent me an email, and she is curious about a book that they're reading. So, Dr. Lyle, I'm currently enjoying the novel Walden 2 by B.F. Skinner, where Skinner is showcasing his theories of behaviorism in the design of a potentially utopian human community. I'm loving the positive story as opposition to some darker dystopian preferences like Brave New World or Animal Farm. So the question is, are all communal or intentional living societies doomed to failure? She's got a couple questions in here. Are any of Skinner's ideas on operant conditioning and cultural engineering valid? And what is it about human nature that has us preferring to guide rather than being guided, which I understand is a big reason for the failure of many of the communities inspired by this novel?
Let's see. A lot of questions there. So I'm not sure I'm going to answer them directly, but let me just sort of free form on B.F. Skinner. So just to give the listeners a little backdrop so you know who this is, because the people may think they know or they know a little bit about B.F. Skinner and what he did or what he thought, but my knowledge of Skinner isn't extensive, but the B.F. Skinner was early and mid 20th century psychologist. He's one of the most influential psychologists in the 20th century, and he was at Harvard University. That's where he spent his career. And he is famous for writing about and discovering principles of what we call operant conditioning. So this is going to be very different than what we're going to call Pavlovian conditioning that was discovered in the very early 1900s by even Ian Pavlov, who is a physiologist in Russia. So Pavlovian conditioning is the notion of what we're going to call pairing. So pairing a bell and with the presentation of food to a dog, if we do that, the presentation of food will automatically cause the dog to salivate. But if we also hit the bell at the same time we're presenting the food, pretty soon the dog, if we keep doing this over and over, the dog will start salivating just to the bell. So that's called Pavlovian conditioning. And that was the discovery of that was hailed as a major advance in human thinking about psychology in general, and became the bedrock of early American behaviorism and this was happening well before B.F. Skinner. So, however, Skinner then comes along and discovers and discusses at length something else, and that something is going to be what we're going to call operant conditioning. And what this means is this is what you would be called reinforcement or punishment. So let's suppose we have a rat, and we are trying to get that rat to turn in a circle. So when that rat turns a little bit, we light up a key that it knows that it can go over and hit that key and get food. Okay, so we didn't pair anything with anything. This little guy did a little behavior, and we reinforced it immediately. And so as a result, the next time he's in that cage, he's going to go back and he's going to start turning that little circle again. And what Skinner would do is he would then reinforce that for a while. Maybe the little rat turns a quarter of a turn to the left. And then after he reinforces that 10 times and the rat's consistently doing that and then going and getting its food, then he waits until it turns a little further than a quarter, until it turns maybe one-third of the way, and he doesn't reinforce it till then. And so in this way, this is what we call shaping, that he shapes the behavior of the organism in order to get reinforcements. So this is different. This is called, like I said, operant conditioning, and this winds up having enormous impact on American education systems. As if you all remember the SRA reading stuff as kids, those of you that are older, Nate won't remember this, he's too young, but they all taught us how to read by using essentially little reinforcement systems, and these were all being derived out of Skinnerian conditioning thinking.
Now I can barely read as is.
Yeah. So at any rate, so Skinner looks at this, and he examines the concepts of classical conditioning, i.e. Pavlovian conditioning and operant conditioning, and he says, look, this is nature. This is animal behavior. I can get an animal to do anything I want. So if I put a rat in a cage and I want him to play ping pong on a little screen, I can get him to do it. And so effectively he's saying, since I can do that, how do you know that that's not what human behavior is? It looks really complicated, but how do you know it's not just a reinforcement history, that somehow it's been essentially stroked in a given pattern, and that is what you're observing? And in fact, he goes further and he says, that's exactly what I think has happened. And this becomes the conventional view of psychology in the 20th century by academic psychology in general. This is going to be what we're going to call the standard social science model, that the reason why a human does what it does is that it is being reinforced for doing this previously. Okay? This gets a little tweak from Albert Bandura, where we find out that if you observe somebody else getting reinforced, that's almost like getting reinforced yourself. So this is going to be observational learning, but it's going to, in principle, follow the same concepts as Skinnerian conditioning. Now, this all sounds fascinating. It, in some ways, it seems positive, because if there's some kind of a problem that somebody's having, let's suppose they're angry or belligerent or they're abusive or they're biting their sister or something like this, then we would say, well, they've just been reinforced for this somehow, And what we need to do is to stop the reinforcement, and then we will improve the behavior, and we can reinforce some other behavior that's what we call pro-social behavior. Well, it turns out the meta theory that I've explained here, which is the meta theory of American behaviorism or standard social science model, it also has a general underlying concept, and that is that the behavior of animals is actually fundamentally quite simple. The reinforcement history may be very, very complicated because you don't know exactly what happened to it in its past. And so if you've got some angry-looking teenager, it must have been that they were abused or some such thing. So you don't know when, and their mom seems like they're nice, and the mom's shrugging their shoulders like, hey, I adopted this kid. I've been sweet to him for 16 years. I don't know what the problem is. And you're thinking, oh, well, you must have done something bad. Or, you know, when did you adopt them? Oh, at age 5? I wonder what happened between, you know, day 1 and day 5. If you adopt them at day 5. So everybody's always been looking back at the reinforcement history, and this dominates clinical psychology to this day. So somebody that's having trouble at 38 years old having orgasms, well, we got to go back in their history and find out, you know, what's holding them back and so on and so forth. So everybody's examining this through the lens of B.F. Skinner, and they don't really know it. They don't understand that that's who, you know, thrust this concept on the world, but he did. Now, it turns out, this is the drum roll, that he was totally wrong, that it's a complete misunderstanding of human nature. It's not just missing by a little bit. It's missing by a country mile. The concept that organisms have very simple learning mechanisms like reinforcement, they're essentially like a recording device. Like, well, if I do that and I get reinforced, then I'm going to do it again. There is some truth in this, but the truth is it's not even close to understanding how organisms are actually wired up. So B.F. Skinner then goes on to write something like Walden 2, which has a few little principles of reinforcement in there, not really much. It's just kind of his general idea of saying, you know what, we can turn humans, we can make them kind of any way we want. So if we want to make them really nice and cooperative, all we have to do is reward nice and cooperative behavior, and they'll be nice and cooperative, okay? Well, it ain't so, okay? Human beings will be nice and cooperative when it's in their personal best interest to be nice and cooperative, and they will be ornery and nasty when it's in their personal interest to be ornery and nasty. And a great example of how B.F. Skinner couldn't possibly figure out a square one of a clinical problem would be man-woman dynamics, because Skinner wouldn't understand that the purpose of the organism is to reproduce genes and to act in ways that are advantageous for gene survival. That means trying to figure out how to negotiate the other team and out-negotiate them at times in order to get the better end of a genetic deal. This now explains why it is that you got 90 million people on Match.com, everybody's struggling to try to get a 10% better deal than the one that they've got in front of them. This is why relationships break up. This is why they're conflicted, et cetera. So we can understand the problems of human nature when we start to see more deeply into the way motivation is constructed. B.F. Skinner would simply say, well, that shouldn't have to happen that way. We would just reinforce people to be in love with each other, and that would be that. You know what I'm saying? And, in fact, that is kind of what he says in Walden 2. So Walden 2 is a very sort of sweet, naive view of the leading American behaviorist on how pliable human nature would be if you had somebody smart enough to kind of set up the reinforcement contingencies in such a way. But it turns out to be an utterly false view of how human nature is constructed. And just to give you a whole series of examples, Walden 2 and B.F. Skinner would essentially believe that the reason why your child is homosexual is because something happened. Some male, for example, must have rubbed his penis, rubbed the kid's penis when he was 3, and therefore he got reinforced and it felt good while he's looking at Uncle Louie. And so therefore that's what caused him to be homosexual. And therefore, in principle, we should be able to rub his penis while he's looking at a female, and we should be able to change it back. there shouldn't be any reason why this shouldn't be completely pliable. Well, I think everyone listening is sophisticated enough to know that they may not know that that it is not caused early. There's people that think that that's true, and it is not true. The truth is that mating search images and our attraction to characteristics in mates is part of mating search images that are embedded in utero. It's before you're ever born. So the so this is, you know, a complete lack naivety that runs through behaviorism. But hey, you know what? It was an inevitable set of inferences that a man that was spent his life with pigeons and rats and shaping their behavior and trying to learn about how they learn things, it would be reasonable that he would extrapolate those simple lessons to human nature, and that he would think that he had solved the puzzle of human beings. He had not, and that solution wouldn't come until evolutionary psychology was born in the early 90s.
Wonderful. I'm always reminded of the time Pavlov was sitting in a bar, and the phone rings, and he goes, "Oh, shit, I forgot to feed the dog."
That's very good. Oh, man. I got to write that one down. That's a winner. All right. Where do we go next?
All right. And so with this with this listener's question, she was wondering also is, do you think that communal or intentional living societies are doomed to failure? And does it have to do with human nature preferring to guide rather than being guided?
Oh, I think that I'm not even sure. We'd have to start defining intentional living communities. I mean, people could like-minded people might put together some sort of group situation where they've got their own rules as to how they're going to do things, and it could work out pretty well. It's not going to tend to work out very well because of the notion that people are very keen on watching the cost benefit of their own behaviors in trade, and so the communal type living tends to essentially try to take people back to a communistic primitive sort of environment where we're all sharing and we all pitch in and then divide, and it's what it's attempting to do. There's a lure to this for some people because essentially they want to take material competition out of the equation, and they want to just set everybody equal, and so then we can all just sort of quote be ourselves, and we can let our own sexiness be the competitive process by which sexual dynamics are resolved. The truth of the matter is that individual differences in the ability to acquire and protect resources winds up being a critical variable inside the female brain for deciding mates. And so there's going to be struggles in any sort of communal situation where everybody's economic situations are going to be a little bit different. And if they're not, then the people who are contributing more to the situation are going to be annoyed. So we're going to be right back to the Stone Age political situation of share, not share. So the more competent people are quickly going to be frustrated that their greater contributions are not being rewarded. And they're going to want more because as they observe the cost-benefit processes, it's essentially undermining their incentive. So it is obvious when we look at the total failure of any communistic society and so far to make any headway at all, that we see that when you essentially realize that your efforts are being divided by 200 or 300 million people and that we're all in this together and we divide equally, then nobody's interested in being productive. And you can see the tremendous difference in productivity in a capitalistic society where if you make $100 million, you get to keep most of it. And so that there's tremendous incentive in capitalistic societies to be productive. When you make systems more communistic, you generally you're de-incentivizing people, and you are it's not working very well. So pretty quickly, people are natural capitalists. They are naturally trying to figure out how to be more successful materially. That's part of animal nature. Animals are literally trying to scheme to try to figure out how they can get more material resources for less effort. They're under a selection pressure by evolution to be as efficient, as effective as they can. Human beings are the same. And so the fact that we can be friendly with other humans doesn't cause us to suddenly say, well, let's all just pitch in and divide equally. And so this is why some of the kinds of things like this, like Walden 2, are always going to fail, because your more competent people are going to sniff out pretty quickly that they're getting sandbagged by the less industrious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Next question is, we're changing topics a little bit to
sure.
relationships and mating strategies.
Okay.
So the question is for Dr. Lyle. You mentioned that the legitimacy of casual mating as a strategy for this species can be demonstrated by the fact that both men and women are willing to engage in it under certain conditions. However, you also mentioned that the ideal arrangement for a pair bond relationship from the male's point of view is to be in a committed relationship with his wife, to engage in sexual relations with her frequently, but also to have sex on the side with a chippy from time to time.
I'm going to get in big trouble someday for that. Go ahead.
Well, this is his words, I guess. But
yeah, sure.
And perhaps there's some fantasy attached to it, which, you know.
Right.
What you didn't really discuss in depth is the fact that, as far as I know, this ideal is almost never realized in modern-day relationships. My question is, yeah, I think
okay.
it is, to be honest, but
yes.
it's just not out there. So my question is, if this pair-bond relationship ideal has existed in psychological hardwiring of males over time, why isn't there a willingness of females to be accepting of it, as opposed to casual mating strategy where both sides are willing to play? Why would this ideal persist in men but be almost universally rejected by women? Are there certain conditions or personality characteristics that determine whether females are willing to go along with their pair bond partners while their pair bond partners pursue the chippy strategy?
This is a priceless question, okay? All right, we're going to start out right away that you know how in the hot crazy matrix that guy so brilliantly did, if people haven't seen it, it's a lot of fun, the hot crazy matrix, where they say that the really hot female who is emotionally stable and all cool, that's what they call a unicorn. They exist in theory, but nobody's ever seen one. Okay, that's really funny. Well, if you want the true unicorn, that is the situation where everybody's happy in the relationship, including the fact that the woman is fine with the guy screwing around on the side. That is truly – there is no personality characteristic to find in a female like that. That is a freak of nature. Now – let's talk about why, and let's talk about why this is a male dream scenario that is not going to come about without walking through a minefield. The reason is that in for example, in the casual mating situation, the reason why we have both the reason why you have a casual mating situation at all, the reason why the males would want to play this is obvious. They would want to essentially spill their seed and then walk over the hill and dump the cost of child raising on the female that they inseminated. That this would be males would be highly motivated to do this. Essentially, this is just sheer math of gene reproduction. So it's no surprise that this is a very, very exciting possibility, and it's actually highly motivated behavior in males. Now, it wouldn't persist to exist in males unless the females were willing to play. That isn't quite accurate. It could exist if females were not willing to play, but they could get tricked into playing. So there's actually two methods by which this could persist in evolution. Number one would be if the females were willing to play the game, and the other one would be the females are not willing to play the game, but the males are sufficiently deceptive that they trick them into it anyway. Now, the truth is that both of those things are happening and have been omnipresent forces in evolution. Females have been willing to play casual mating strategy under the conditions, particularly when they are genetically inferior to the males. And so they are a female 6 willing to tumble with a 9 male who is showing her no evidence at all that he's going to stick around after next week. He's just going to attempt to fill her uterus with his seed for the next week, and you know, he's got a pretty good shot, probably a 25 or 30% shot that he will impregnate her in the next week, and then he's going to take that, you know, just going to take off over the hill and leave. Okay, that has happened obviously hundreds of millions of times in the history of this species. Why the female would put up with that behavior is because he's got fancier DNA than she is, and her offspring from him will be more sexually attractive than she is herself. So this is why that strategy, under certain conditions, will be genetically profitable and therefore executed by the female. Now, the other conditions where that's going to happen is going to be where the female is going to be tricked by the male into the male exercising short-term mating strategy on the female who had no intention that that's where it was going to go. So the males are obviously they've been selectively bred by evolution to get very good at lying, even to the point of being self-deceptive, so that their lies are exceptionally good in this regard. And females have been selected by evolution to try to detect the lying. And there's been an evolutionary arms race between lying and lying detection that comes to the extraordinary subtlety that we have today in man-woman communication over these issues as people are getting to know each other and thinking about sleeping with each other. The i.e. Carole King's song, you know, "Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?" "Tonight with words unspoken, you say I'm the only one." Like, how beautiful is that? Like, the female's looking at this guy saying, boy, everything about you is saying that I'm it and that you're going to be with me forever, but you're not actually saying it. Okay? So this is all this very extraordinary game that's being played. Now, the question is, so we see that it has been in females' advantage to at times play casual mating, and also it has been at times when she has been tricked into it, thinking that she wasn't playing it. That is why it still exists. Now, pair bonding is another strategy that is played by both members of the species, where the male is actually honestly signaling and follows through on the concept that he's going to invest heavily in this female, and that what the female would like in principle would be all of his resources directed towards her and her offspring. All residual resources above his survival should be directed there. That's what she wants. And in fact, that is what a pair bond situation, that's what the female is trading for. The female is basically saying, you know, I'm going to give you my sexuality. I'm going to give all you my time and energy to raising your children. I'm all in on this, and I want you to all be in on this. Now, this is why, from the standpoint of the male, this is not ideal. We could improve the situation here if he gets to do casual mating on the side while he makes his primary investment in a pair bond, i.e. this is what I call wife, chippy. In other words, this is exactly what's going on in a typical male's brain, and this is exactly how he'd like to play. The question on the table is, gee, why don't you find this anywhere? Well, you sort of do whenever males can get away with it. So just look at the Muslim world, where we have a whole bunch of men that can't mate with anybody because some men have 4 wives. This is effectively exactly what's happening, is that one male is getting access to more than one female at a time. And so this is it's quite possible, if people get themselves in sufficient positions of power, that males will try to pull this off. So this is a attractive, wealthy male that not only is sleeping with his wife, but is also managing to sleep with somebody else on the side. Often the reason why it would require wealth, for example, is because they may be needing to do some provisioning for the chippy, because the chippy is not wanting to just trade for his genes. She's actually also wanting some resources. So this is like the mistress, okay? Now, the question is, gee, why haven't wives been adapted to being fine with this? The answer is they're not at all fine with it. They want all of the resources. That's what they want. So they don't want any resources being directed towards any other woman and any other children, because the only purpose of, in principle, of the woman is to bear children. God knows. Let's not let the feminists hear that quote out of me. This is, we're talking like a biologist here. That's the whole purpose of a female is to bear children. The purpose of a male is to, you know, inseminate females and get resources to talk females into inseminating them. I mean, this is in principle what's happening. So, of course, the female by nature is going to be very much on guard and upset, and it's a total direct conflict between her and her Parabon husband about any chippy on the side. So, no, there would be no reason for a female to ever be okay with this and happy with it. And if they are okay and happy with it, they're probably not interested in their husband. Okay? What they probably have is a marriage of convenience, and nobody's screwing anybody except the husband screwing the chippy on the side. So that's how that works.
Which reminds me, I got a question for you. What does Bill Clinton say to Hillary after sex?
Oh, God. I don't know. I don't know what.
I'll be home in 20 minutes.
Oh, man. You're bowling some strikes tonight, Chief. Well done.
All right. Next question.
Very good. Go ahead.
All right. And so the next question. One more. Okay. Last one here. There's a couple of questions here, so just pick the one that the one that makes the most sense here.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Dr. Lyle, what's your opinion about the relationship concept that some people refer to as the betaization process? A simple explanation is that it's the process that occurs between a pair-bonded male and female by which the female engages in certain manipulative behaviors to cause the male to behave in a way that is best for her and her offspring's survival. To tie this question into the purpose of your show, Beating Your Genes, do you have any advice for men on how to maximize their happiness in relationships in light of this theory? Advice that he's seen include the following. Either avoid the situation altogether by never agreeing to be exclusive or pair-bonded, or to have a serial pair-bond relationship but do not let them last much longer than the honeymoon phase, i.e. end the relationship at the first sign of a significant complaint or argument or nagging or request for compromise, and then don't spend time trying to work things out and trying to get things back to where they were. Instead, just look to move on to a new partner and begin the new honeymoon phase.
Okay. Now let's talk about this, because I'm not sure what all this guy's referring to, but we're going to talk to the heart of, I think, the concept that's perplexing and disturbing for people, and that is what is the enjoyment, payoff long term for what we're going to call a romantic love relationship, and what does this really look like? So in theory, is it the case that human beings were built in such a way that they are going to be inevitably disappointed in their relationship, and that the only reasonable way to behave is to try to essentially jump from high to high, like Elizabeth Taylor, getting married 8 or 9 times or whatever the heck she did. Now, I would say that human beings are built with this euphoric process of falling in love that is going to be a major signal that tells you that from the best you can tell, you are being over-rewarded, which is that's what falling in love is a feeling that I'm getting a hell of a deal here. And so it's the same feeling that you're going to get for the same reasons that if you get a great sale on an outfit at Macy's, okay, it's like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is only $120. This is worth $350 all day long. That same feeling of excitement, like, yes, I want to make this transaction, this is a very good deal, that's exactly what's happening in the nervous system, except at the most profound level, because the chips are so high, because you're all about gene reproduction. So if it appears to you that you are getting one hell of a deal in a potential pair bond, that's what we call falling in love. Okay, and there is nothing like it. in the human nervous system. There is nothing that will hit as many circuits as hard as that. Now, just as once you buy that outfit at Macy's, when you bring it home, the there may be reasons why it was $120. So, therefore, we will find that a lot of these relationships will crash and burn in 3 months or 6 months, okay? Because we found out the reason it was on sale. So that is precisely what happens, all right? Now, that is not anything inherently frustrating and miserable and depressing about human nature. That's just part of the inherent risks of the game. And people will be fooled again and again by this because the nature of the neurochemical shift that takes place when you're, quote, falling in love will look right past some red flags that are maybe obvious to a third party that are basically saying, look, I see some characterological problems here, or I see some personality problems here with your potential mate, but it doesn't matter. If you feel like you're getting a screaming deal, then it's going to turn out that very often those will blow right past any sort of warning signs. So that's why very often things will blow up in a few months, and I call it the law of 90 days. Like very often something that looks really good after 2 weeks doesn't look anything like you thought it was going to look after 90 days. Now the question is, where are we after 2 years? Is it possible for human beings to be happy, and how happy and for how long? Well, you cannot be euphoric indefinitely. That is impossible because part of the euphoria is this major signal that is actually trying to get you to repetitively engage and dominate that person's attention because you're trying to get rid of all competition and you're trying to essentially secure a trade, okay? So the euphoria that's involved in early romance cannot be had indefinitely. That's not a possibility. That's no more a possibility than your first bite of a really good chocolate bar. You know what I'm saying? Let's put three of those bars in front of you. That the last bite of the third bar is not going to be like the first bite of the first bar. There's no way that's going to happen. You know, your eighth piece of See's candy just is not having the same impact as the first piece. That is because the delta or the change of the system's circumstances from one moment to the next is not as great. So when we go from no relationship to, quote, falling in love, we have now massively improved your genetic circumstances according to all estimates. And so all systems are firing, saying, dominate, you know, let this dominate your existence. Make sure you figure out where that person is. Try to figure out what it is that they like about you. Try to enhance that. Try to show that you're a great deal. You will do this. You'll do that for them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is all trying to essentially do as much as you can to make the other person an offer they cannot refuse. This is very much like loss leaders in any kind of sale, discounts, et cetera, et cetera. You're essentially trying to say, you know, look at what a great deal I am. And very often people are overselling it. In fact, of course they are. They have to because their competition will be overselling it to get secure those same people. So as a result, as people actually start to make the deal, they start to renegotiate it. Okay? And so as a result, it's going to turn out very often that it's not quite as good a deal as we thought. Things sort of cooled down, but it still may be well worth having. This is after we find out that actually it wasn't actually a Saks Fifth Avenue suit. It was a Saks Fifth Avenue knockoff, but it's still a pretty nice suit, and so it's still a pretty good deal for $120. Okay? So this is sort of what happens. Now, the question is, will this fade off into a grumbling, you know, brother-sister-like, not very interesting relationship as we start to look out 2, 3, 4, 5 years? And the answer is not necessarily at all, okay? Now, it might, and in fact, it very likely will, but it isn't inherently necessary that that takes place. If it turns out that those two people actually continue to discover in each other characterological strengths that are impressive And if the people do not dramatically change in their mate value, in other words, nobody gains 40 pounds, nobody, you know, winds up with some illness that winds up being devastating and expensive and problematic, et cetera, et cetera. You might say, well, gee, that's not fair. What happens if I get breast cancer and they have to remove a breast or something? Well, it really isn't up to – it isn't a question of whether or not people stick together and do the highly conscientious thing. The question is, how much do they want to be there? That's really what love is. And love is the inference that we have a very good deal, okay? And can we maintain a feeling that we have a very good deal? Yes, you can. But not usually, okay? But you can. And so there's people, you've had this happen in many things of your life. So you may have had a home that you bought, and you really, really liked it, and you may have considered moving at times, but you may be very happy there. And it's not the fanciest thing, and you could even afford fancier or better potentially, but you really like it. That's what a mate can be like, okay? And so this is it is quite possible for people to be long-term happy, sexually interested in each other. It's not typical of the species, but it is possible of the species. And I think the concept that we should say, oh, well, forget it. We're not going to even commit to a pair bond. Forget about that, because that isn't really what we would want. Because I'd really like to have a chippy on the side. No, you giving up a chippy on the side in protection of a pair bond that's really worthwhile is a very reasonable cost-benefit analysis of understanding that life has compromises in it that are inherent in human relations. You and your partner are not the same person. You are different people. The question is, can you have an intersection in a relationship which causes a great deal of moods of happiness in both people? The answer is yes, it's possible, not typical. And the answer for many of us is to leave relationships when they are clearly signaling to our nervous system that they are not a good deal, but search for and hope to secure something that can last a long time and maybe a lifetime.
Fantastic. Yeah, this user, it sounds like they're from one of the forums on Reddit that I've read through that has to do with evolutionary psychology. And some of the information there is valid, and it's actually much of what you talk about here on the podcast. And some of the information, actually, they're a little bit off in that they blame females for what they say, in essence, taking an alpha male and turning him to a beta male. And from what you're suggesting, right, and from what we've kind of learned on the podcast, what's actually happening is the male has most likely been bluffing that he's fancier than he is, and as time goes on, he just goes back into who he actually was, at which point the female loses attraction, or they both just kind of drift away.
There's all kinds of things can go south, and the truth of the matter is that typically the sort of the average person. And when I say average, I mean average. The average person is not typically going to have the characterological strengths and emotional stability to make a really excellent choice and then feel like that's a really good choice forever, because probably the choices they're making, the person on the other side, is really not that impressive and won't continue to win points over competition behind character strengths that are being demonstrated in behavior. But that is not true for all people. So the characterological strengths can continually over time add to people's attractiveness. And that is a possibility in human nature, but it's not a typical possibility. But it doesn't have to do with intelligence or fanciness. It has to do with some character traits that come in inherently natural to some people. And so some relationships can actually get better over time. They may not be as wild or sexual, but they can actually be better in terms of feeling how valuable the mate is and how lucky you are to be with them. That is an absolute possibility of human nature.
Wonderful. I guess we have something to look forward to as we journey on through this life.
Yeah, we hope so.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.